I handled the heavy engraved medallions he won for advocating peace, his passion in later years. I read the article he wrote called Where Uncle Sam's Solar Plexus is Located, in which he argues that America's most vulnerable spot was its hub of weapons manufacturing in the mid-Atlantic. A nation too reliant on the killing business, he wrote, was in a bad way. Its potential for growth, on the other hand, he claimed lay in its, quote, public school. It teaches the lesson of personal usefulness, of friendship across race lines, of equality before law. This is its source of power. I sniffed his journals, the small leather ones he carried around in his breast pocket as a young abolitionist. They smelled of warmed butter. They spilled forth drawings of caterpillars, spiders, leaves. I went home empty-handed. I went home lost, as ever. It was a couple months later that I came across the detail that would send a flash of heat up my neck. I was back in Chicago, still searching for answers, this time in a copy of one of David Starr Jordan's fish collecting manuals, A Guide to the Study of Fishes. I had smiled through his friendly introduction in which he promised his readers that fish can be found anywhere, the old swimming hole or the deep eddy at the root of the old stump. I flipped through his diagrams of jawbones, pectoral fins, air bladders, and then on page 430, I saw it. Under a section called How to Secure Fishes, he divulges a secret to his intrepid readers, the ones who have stayed with him this long. His favorite trick for catching the peskiest of fish, the ones that evade capture by darting into the cracks of tide pools. Poison. The particular variety he recommends? A dangerous and powerful substance, one he once described as the bitterest thing in the world. Strychnine. Chapter 10. A Veritable Chamber of Horrors. The erosion of David Starr Jordan's presidential power began almost immediately after Jane Stanford's death. Displeased by his rash dismissal of Jane's informant, Julius Gubel, the Board of Trustees voted to strip David of his authority to fire faculty. And a few years later, in 1913, the board asked him to step down altogether. They allowed him to keep the ceremonial title of chancellor, but divested him of any remaining executive power. With a heaping amount of free time suddenly on his plate, David found himself a new hobby. His travels as a fish collector had taken him a few times to a village in the Italian Alps called Aosta. There, he had seen something shocking. Aosta was a sort of sanctuary city for people with disabilities, both mental and physical. For centuries, the Catholic Church had provided shelter, food, and care to people who had been rejected by their families because of their condition. And many of these people had ended up becoming skilled workers. In the fields or in kitchens, many of them ended up falling in love, getting married, having children. What had emerged was a sort of upside-down town, a town where the abnormal was normal, where people often disabled by society received the support that allowed them to flourish. Some might see something beautiful in this town, a radically humane way of helping society's most vulnerable live with dignity. But David Starr Jordan, when he visited in the 1880s, had described it as a, quote, veritable chamber of horrors, overrun with creatures with less intelligence than the goose and less decency than the pig. Over the years, the town of Aosta continued to nag at David. He worried that it was proof of that thing Louis Agassiz had suggested could take place in the animal world, degeneration. David wrongly believed that immobile creatures like sea squirts and barnacles had once been higher forms of fish and crabs, but had degenerated back into lazier, weaker, less complex, less intelligent forms of life as a result of acquiring resources parasitically. More broadly, he believed that any kind of long-term aid to a creature would result in its eventual physical and cognitive decline. He called this misunderstanding of how nature works, quote, animal pauperism, and he worried that the same phenomenon was taking place in Aosta, that the people of Aosta were literally degenerating into a, quote, new species of man. So he began working on a book that would alert the public to the dangers of charity causing, as he believed it did, quote, the survival of the unfittest. a book that would recommend the extermination of these, quote, cretins as the only way to prevent against a worldwide decay of the human race. A book that would rely heavily on a word that had only recently come into being a few decades earlier, a word without much popularity in America when David first began. A word he himself would champion with so much zeal and scientific authority he'd help propagate it on U.S. soil. Eugenics. The word was coined back in 1883 by a British scientist named Francis Galton, a famous polymath in his own right, who also happened to be the half-cousin of Charles Darwin. When On the Origin of Species had first come out, Galton had read his cousin's book and been so inspired he called it a, quote, new epoch on my mental development. Once Galton had come to comprehend that there were forces of natural selection shaping the array of life on Earth, it dawned on him that perhaps you could actually manipulate those forces to select for a master race of humans by breeding out traits he incorrectly believed to be associated with blood. Poverty, criminality, illiteracy, feeble-mindedness, promiscuity, and more. He called this technique of killing off groups of people you don't like eugenics, Greek for good and birth, and he began telling anyone who would listen to him, Darwin's cousin, about his scientific-sounding plan for making Europe great again. He trotted out his ideas at fancy gatherings and in fancy magazines like Nature and Macmillan's. He even wrote a sci-fi novel called The Eugenic College of Can't-Say-Where about a community where only those who passed rigorous tests were allowed to procreate, and anyone else who tried would be imprisoned and punished with, quote, sharp severity. Galton saw his book as a happy tale, a how-to guide for saving the human race from decay. Plenty of people dismissed Galton. There is a chance that eugenics could have remained in the realm of speculative fiction had a small group of influential scientists not championed its cause so zealously. David Starr Jordan, despite all his railing against the dangers of psiosophy, was one of the earliest and loudest. He drank the eugenics Kool-Aid hard and fast. He began hallucinating evidence of heritable personality traits everywhere. Even his smitten biographer, Edward McNall Burns, had to admit it was ludicrous. He attached so exaggerated an importance to biological inheritance that he seemed to think almost every quality of human personality could be explained thereby. Poverty, laziness, the ability to classify birds, all simply a matter of the blood. David Starr Jordan was one of the first to bring Galton's ideas back to America. As early as the 1880s, decades before most American eugenicists got the fever, David had begun to tuck these ideas into his lectures at Indiana University, informing students that traits like pauperism and degeneracy were heritable and thus could be exterminated just as swamps are drained. In time, he began taking the ideas out of the classroom, giving speeches to large gatherings of prominent politicians warning that the republic shall endure only as long as the human harvest is good. He published his first pro-eugenics article in 1898 and followed it with a flurry of books advocating for the cleansing of the gene pool, the human harvest, the blood of the nation, your family tree, and so on. In his writings, David took all the kinds of people he wanted to rid from the earth, the paupers and drinkers and, quote, cretins and, quote, imbeciles and, quote, idiots and morally depraved, and he lumped them into one category, the unfit. Unfit, such a catchy word, so evocative, so trim, it could take his opinions about what groups of people deserved to live and wrap them in the cloak of science. Unfit, not one man's judgment, just a reality of nature. On speaking tours, David made stops at churches and almshouses where he'd warn the devoted staffs about the dangers of their work, fomenting, as he claimed it did, the survival of the unfit. He'd share the cautionary tale of Aosta, describing a land where, quote, goitered and imbecile creatures roamed free, drooling, panhandling, behaving indecently. An old woman, he claimed, once even licked my hands like a dog. He had sketches made of the people he had supposedly met there. An old woman hunched over a cane, grimacing maniacally with missing teeth and warts. A man with a coconut-sized goiter sprouting from his neck. And he warned that this was where the human race was headed if society didn't take action. The solution? Some eugenicists considered paying elites to have more babies to flood the gene pool with superior stock. Others suggested legalizing polygamy for the upper class. But David Starr Jordan had what he considered a far better idea, a way of making real that, quote, extermination he had once proposed to his students. By simply snipping the reproductive organs of people he saw as unfit, David assured audiences that, quote, each individual cretin should be the last of his generation. In the wake of these talks and similar ones given by other early eugenicists, back alley sterilizations and occasionally executions began taking place all over America. In 1915, a doctor in Chicago named Harry Haselden began leaving disabled babies to die, earning him the nickname the Black Stork. There were rumors of a mental hospital in Illinois that was intentionally killing off its patients with tuberculosis-infected milk. According to scholar Paul Lombardo, who has done heroic work unearthing huge chunks of this history, a handful of doctors began boasting of sterilizing unfit patients, while countless more performed the operation in what was sometimes called the quiet way, behind the scenes and without legal authority. But David Starr Jordan, good Puritan, was not a fan of breaking the law, so he began advocating for the legalization of eugenic sterilization. In 1907, a few of his friends from Bloomington successfully legalized forced eugenic sterilization in Indiana, the first such law not just in the country, but the world. 2 years later, David helped get it passed in California. His commitment to the cause apparent, he was asked to chair the Eugenics Committee of the American Breeders Association. He eagerly accepted. I can't believe I made it through my entire education without ever learning about our country's leading role in the eugenics movement. But eugenics seemed as roaring a part of American culture as flappers and the Model T. This was not a fringe movement. It crossed party lines. The first five presidents of the 20th century hailed its promise. Eugenics courses were taught at prestigious universities all across the country, from Harvard to Stanford to Yale to UC Berkeley to Princeton and back again. There were eugenics magazines, eugenics cosmetics, even eugenics competitions. Often held at state fairs under festive white tents, contests would be held for the fittest families and the best babies, measured and weighed like pumpkins. Blue ribbons for the fairest skin, the roundest head, the most symmetrical features. And as for the losers, slowly more and more states passed sterilization laws. Connecticut, Iowa, New Jersey. Have a sexually transmitted disease? Snip. An epileptic seizure? Snip. An out-of-wedlock baby? A criminal record? A low score on a standardized test? Snip. 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 Still, the actual rate of sterilization was low. The policies David helped to put in place required an unfit person to first come into contact with the law or the medical, education, or welfare system before a sterilization could take place. Then, in 1916, an American guy named Madison Grant published a eugenics book that a German guy named Hitler would later call his Bible. In the book, The Passing of the Great Race, Grant proposed a policy that in certain ways resembled Galton's sci-fi vision, that all the nation's, quote, moral perverts, mental defectives, and hereditary cripples be rounded up under the guise of charity and sterilized. American eugenicists thought it was brilliant. When over a decade later, Hitler passed Germany's first mandatory sterilization law, American eugenicist and Dr. Joseph de Jarnette whined, "The Germans are beating us at our own game." Not all Americans, however, were so gung-ho about this plan of creating a better society via genetic cleansing. There were some very loud voices of dissent. In 1910, the president of the American Bar Association called eugenic sterilization barbaric. A lawyer with Oregon's Anti-Sterilization League called it an engine of tyranny and oppression. The Catholic Church was one of its loudest opponents on the grounds that it violated the sanctity of life. In 1906, Pennsylvania Governor Samuel Pennypacker struck down what would have been the first compulsory sterilization law in the world, saying, "To permit such an operation would be to inflict cruelty upon a helpless class, which the state has undertaken to protect." And then there was the mounting scientific dissent. More and more scholars were calling the science behind eugenics, quote, rot, pointing out that a person's environment played a crucial role in many of the traits eugenicists thought could be eradicated by sterilization: poverty, promiscuity, illiteracy, criminality. Other scientists questioned the validity of the concept of degeneration, the idea that charity causes physical deterioration. They were unconvinced that life moved backwards in the way David claimed it did, unconvinced that sea squirts, for example, had devolved into immobile sacs as a result of relying on food from other species. These skeptics would later be proved right. And then there was that key point in On the Origin of Species, that crucial point that both David and before him Francis Galton had missed. What does Darwin say is the best way of building a species strong, of allowing it to endure into the future, to withstand the blows of chaos in all her mighty forms? Flood, drought, rising sea levels, fluctuating temperatures, invasions of competitors, predators, pests. Variation. Variation in genes and hence in behavior and physical traits. Homogeneity is a death sentence. To rid a species of its mutants and outliers is to make that species dangerously vulnerable to the elements. In nearly every chapter of Origin, Darwin hails the power of variation. He marvels over how diverse gene pools are healthier and stronger, how intercrossing between different types of individuals gives more vigor and fertility to their offspring, how even worms and plants that can produce perfect replicas of themselves are equipped for sex, for introducing variety back into the gene pool. "How strange are these facts," he cries, with an exclamation point. "How simply are these facts explained on the view of an occasional cross with a distinct individual being advantageous or indispensable?" Diversify your genetic portfolio would be another way of saying it. You never know which traits could prove useful as conditions change. Darwin even goes out of his way to warn against meddling. The danger, as he sees it, is the fallibility of the human eye, our inability to comprehend complexity. Traits that might seem, quote, abhorrent to our ideas of fitness could actually be beneficial to a species or ecosystem, or could in time become beneficial as conditions change. It was that ungainly neck that gave the giraffe an edge over its competitors, the seeming dead weight of blubber that allowed the seal to thrive in the advancing cold, the divergent human brain that might hold the key to inventions, discoveries, and revolutions that the majority is unable to fathom. Man can only act on external and visible characters. Nature cares nothing for appearances, Darwin writes. She can act on every internal organ, on every shade of constitutional difference, on the whole machinery of life. Consider the case of the cyanobacteria, a tiny green speck in the sea so insignificant to the human eye that for centuries we didn't even have a name for it. Until one day in the 1980s, when scientists accidentally discovered it was producing a significant portion of the oxygen we breathe. Now we revere it, this tiny green speck, Prochlorococcus marinus. We fight to protect it. This was the kind of scenario Darwin prophesied, why he warned so unambiguously against attempting to rank Earth's bounty. Quote, "Which group will prevail? No man can predict." And this wariness, this humility, this reverence for an ecological complexity that defies human comprehension is, in fact, a very old idea. It's a basic philosophical concept, sometimes called the dandelion principle. In some contexts, a dandelion might be considered a weed to be culled. In others, it's a valuable medicinal herb to be cultivated. The eugenicists failed to consider this very simple principle of relativity. By trying to cull the gene pool of its indispensable variety, they were in fact foiling their very best shot of building a master race. And yet, not a single one of these arguments, philosophical, moral, or scientific, seemed to penetrate David's certainty about eugenics. He, along with other eugenicists, dismissed their dissenters as naive, sentimental, too dim to see the bigger picture. "Education can never replace heredity," David declared in a eugenics manifesto entitled Your Family Tree, adding, "An Arab proverb puts the matter bluntly. Father a weed, mother a weed. Do you expect daughter to be a saffron root?" In fact, in the face of mounting dissent, David only pushed harder to create a mandatory eugenics program in America. He persuaded his friend, the wealthy widow Mary Harriman, to give over $500,000, about $13 million today, to seed the Eugenics Research Office, a shiny new pro-eugenics research hub in Cold Spring Harbor, New York. The ERO would go on to collect boatloads of data on tens of thousands of Americans. The researchers would then use the information to construct family trees that suggested that complicated phenomena such as poverty, criminality, promiscuity, dishonesty, and a fondness for the ocean, which was given the clinical term of thalassophilia, were predestined in the blood. While the ERO did turn up a few legitimate discoveries, useful information about the inheritance of albinism and neurofibromatosis, for example, the majority of its work would be unequivocally debunked. The researchers had a habit of fudging data, of encoding gossip as fact, and it is now well established that intergenerational poverty, or criminality, for example, is brought about by a swirl of insidious environmental factors. In spite of the studies churned out by the prestigious ERO, it also received substantial support from the Rockefeller family and the Carnegie Institution. By the early 1920s, the public was beginning to change its tune on the subject. More and more doctors who had performed sterilization faced lawsuits, and the Supreme Court of New Jersey decided to strike down its eugenic sterilization law due to its, quote, palpable inhumanity and immorality. It was looking like perhaps David's dream of a national eugenics program had finally fizzled out. Enter Albert Priddy. Priddy was the slick-haired doctor in charge of the Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded in Lynchburg, Virginia. He was a zealous eugenicist known for having sterilized women for being, quote, man-crazy, having, quote, wanderlust, telling, quote, coarse stories, and even passing notes in class. In 1917, he had been sued by a man named George Mallory for sterilizing his wife and daughter while Mallory had been traveling for work. Dr. Priddy's justification? That a house full of women with no man in charge must have been a brothel. I am a human being as well as you, Mallory wrote to Priddy after learning what Priddy had done. You ought be ashamed of yourself. Just stop and think how she's been treated. The judge sided with Priddy, but the colony was shaken by the lawsuit and urged Priddy to cool it on the sterilizations. Instead of repenting, though, Dr. Priddy dug in. He began searching for a case that would prove to juries that feeble-mindedness was hereditary and must be stopped by sterilization. And one day in 1924, Dr. Priddy found what he'd been looking for. A young woman named Carrie Buck was dropped off at the colony. She was an orphan and had become pregnant at the age of 17 after being raped. After she gave birth, her foster parents sent her away to the colony. When Carrie landed on Dr. Priddy's doorstep, he was struck by something familiar about her face, those high cheekbones, those pensive eyes. It turned out that her biological mother, Emma Buck, was also in residence at the colony under allegations of being a prostitute. After Priddy realized the two women were related, he had Carrie's baby, Vivian, tested by a famous eugenicist researcher from the ERO. The researcher ran a few tests, likely running a coin in front of the baby's eyes or clapping his hands to test her attention, and determined that little Vivian showed backwardness. This official assessment then gave Priddy the thing he had been dreaming of for years. Proof that, quote, feeble-mindedness was heritable over three generations. A lawyer named Irving Whitehead was appointed to represent Carrie Buck to protest the sterilization, but scholarship by Lombardo suggests that Whitehead was a proponent of eugenic sterilization, likely in cahoots with Dr. Priddy. When the prosecution accused Carrie of coming from a, quote, shiftless, ignorant, and worthless class of people, Whitehead failed to provide what could have been a decent defense for Buck. She had good school records and neighbors and teachers willing to vouch for her integrity, and he kept appealing the ruling until it got all the way to the Supreme Court. The year was 1927. The month was April. David Starr Jordan was 76 years old. He had begun to grow weak. Just a year earlier, his son Eric, little Eric, his replacement for Barbara, this boy who had grown into a paleontologist, had died in a car accident at the age of 22 as he headed out on a collecting trip. David was weak from grief, weak from exhaustion, weak from too many years of formaldehyde eating away at his eyes. His vision was going. He had developed diabetes. In just a couple of years, he would need a wheelchair. But he would have been energized by the reports pouring through his radio. Scientists from the ERO, an institution he had helped bring into existence, were providing evidence to the Supreme Court asserting that, quote, moral delinquency was encoded in the blood and could be eliminated through mandatory sterilization. This notion that had once been a hazy idea in David's mind had, through his proselytizing, become a thing of this earth. An entity so real it was poised on the precipice of entering federal law. The nine somber-faced judges considered the evidence. The fancy words and intricate family trees that suggested sterilization was a sound way of protecting citizens against crime, illness, poverty, suffering. They considered the girl, Carrie, timid and trusting. Asked during her first hearing if she had anything to say for herself, she had replied, "No, sir, I have not. It is up to my people." Her people voted 8-1 to make compulsory sterilizations legal, quote, "in order to prevent our being swamped with incompetence." 5 months later, Carrie Buck was taken into a squat brick building at the Lynchburg Colony and brought to the second floor, where a skylight provided extra light for the surgeon. She was placed on an operating table and sliced open just above her pubis. Using probes, the surgeon located her fallopian tubes and swiftly ligated each one. He then sealed the cut with carbolic acid so the dead end would hold tight. Carrie awoke to a new reality, that no other child with her distinctive eyes, with her unique mix of traits, would ever walk this earth again. "They done me wrong," she would later say. "They done us all wrong." Carrie's case paved the way for over 60,000 sterilizations, performed legally and against people's will all over America in the name of public welfare. Many of the quote unfit have been forgotten, but researchers have fought to keep what stories they can find in the light. In 2007, a historian from the University of Michigan, Alexandra Ministern, discovered a set of microfilm reels in an old file cabinet in a government office in Sacramento. On them was a sort of eugenics registry, the names and demographic information of every person sterilized in David's adopted home of California from 1919 to 1952. The list was nearly 20,000 people long. Stern has spent years analyzing the records with a team, and together they've been able to fill in the picture of what unfit really meant, what kinds of people lived inside that category. As Stern writes, those deemed unfit often were young women pronounced promiscuous, the sons and daughters of Mexican, Italian, and Japanese immigrants, and men and women who transgressed sexual norms. Other studies have shown how women of color were disproportionately targeted for sterilization. The U.S. government has admitted to forcefully sterilizing over 2,500 Native American women in the early 1970s. The Eugenics Board of North Carolina sought out and sterilized hundreds of Black women during the 1960s and 70s. And, mind-bogglingly, approximately a third of all Puerto Rican women were sterilized by the U.S. government between 1933 and 1968. The ruling that made this all possible, by the way, is still on the books. That's right. The Supreme Court ruling has never been overturned. At our highest level, it is still written into law that if the government deems you unfit, officials have the authority to pull you from your home, stick a knife through your abdomen, and terminate your bloodline. While most legal scholars will tell you that technically the law is in a state of limbo because every state has since repealed its eugenic sterilization law, the reality is that nearly half of the states still allow for involuntary sterilization of people deemed unfit. Only now they use words like mentally incompetent or mentally deficient. Meanwhile, forced sterilization continues to be performed in the quiet way all over the country. Much of it remains undocumented and hard to catch. Coercive sterilizations in low-income hospitals, meth clinics, prisons, institutions for people with disabilities, and beyond. But big cases come to light every few years. Over the period of 2006 to 2010, for example, nearly 150 women were illegally sterilized in California prisons, without the women's consent and occasionally without their knowledge. And in the summer of 2017, a Tennessee judge named Sam Benningfield was found to be offering petty criminals reduced jail sentences in exchange for being sterilized. There it is, that same mindset, Galton's folly. This misbelief that poverty and suffering and criminality are a matter of the blood and can be excised from society with a knife. Eugenic ideology is anything but dead in this country. We are sticky with the stuff. Stroll down the National Mall in Washington, D.C., and when you get to 21st Street, look north, and you will see him. Francis Galton, in bronze, over the doorway to our nation's temple to science, the National Academy of Sciences. Walk up the main promenade on Stanford University's campus, and one of the first statues to greet you is that of Louis Agassiz, believer that blacks are subhuman, still presiding from his Corinthian pilaster. Behind him is a massive sandstone building with sweeping archways and a clay tile roof, named in honor of the man who toured our country calling for the, quote, extermination of society's most vulnerable groups, Jordan Hall. Chapter 11, The Ladder. David Starr Jordan remained an ardent eugenicist until his dying day. There's no evidence of any last-moment realization or remorse, not about the thousands of people who were brandished with scars and shame thanks to his efforts, not about the individuals he trampled as he fought to maintain his power, Jane Stanford, the doctors he slandered, the spy he fired, the librarian he accused of sexual perversity. It was chilling, his brutality, his remorselessness, the sheer depth of his descent, the breadth of his rampage. I felt sick. I had been fashioning myself after a villain, after all. A man so sure of himself and his ideas that he was capable of ignoring reason, of ignoring morality, of ignoring the clamor of thousands of people begging him to see the error of his ways. I am a human being as well as you. How had it happened? How had that sweet boy, so devoted to caring for the hidden and insignificant, turned into a man who would so readily kill off the same? Where in his story had he changed, and why? Looking at the full spread of David's emotional anatomy, the most obvious culprit seems to be that thick shield of optimism he was so proud to possess. He had a terrifying capacity for convincing himself that what he wanted was right, writes scholar Luther Speer, who was struck by how David's certainty in himself, his self-delusion and hard-headedness only seemed to intensify over the years. His ability to crush those in his path multiplied even as he became convinced that his path was the one of righteousness which led to progress. As much as David had railed publicly against self-delusion, privately, he seemed to rely on it, especially in times of trial. It is the will of man that shapes the fates. Perhaps that group of psychologists had been right, the ones who warned that positive illusions can ferment into a vicious thing if left unchecked, capable of striking out against anything that stands in its way. But could that have explained all of it? How hard David was able to push his eugenics agenda, how far? Overconfidence, grit, and pride make a dangerous cocktail, surely, but they didn't seem to fully account for how rabidly he devoted himself to the cause of genetic cleansing. I worked backward, looking for the swerve, the event or idea that nudged his rudder, made him veer so disastrously off course. I scanned back through the chapters of his life, the boat trips across the Pacific, the Garden of Eden in Palo Alto, the fire in Bloomington, the starry nights of his boyhood in upstate New York. Year by year I went, sifting through his stories, unstacking the encounters jar by jar, fish by fish. Until eventually I found myself inside a barn on Penakis Island, beneath a halo of circling swallows, examining the germ of an idea that Louis Agassiz had implanted in young David's mind. It was a belief that there is a ladder built in to nature, a scala naturae, a divine hierarchy from bacteria to humans that points objectively toward better. This idea rebuilt David's world. It transformed his shameful habit of collecting flowers into, quote, missionary work of the highest order. It filled the cavity of his chest with a burst of purpose that sailed him through life, winning him jobs, awards, wives, children, presidencies. It fueled his work through one disaster and then the next. Onward he went, reading nature like a compass, believing that in the shape of a fin or a skull lay moral guidance. He was sure that if he looked closely enough, he could glean whom to emulate and whom to condemn. He could glean, in short, the true path to enlightenment, to peace, to whatever fruits lay at the top of that ladder. And when he thought he saw humanity beginning to slip, He felt called to rescue it by any means necessary. He wielded his belief in a natural order like a blade, convincing people that sterilization was the soundest way, the only way, of saving the human race. I just wish he had considered what Oliver Cromwell once said, Luther Speer told me on the phone one June morning as he tried to make sense of this man he had studied for so many years. I beseech thee in the bowels of Christ, consider that thee might be mistaken. Are you saying you wish he had more doubt? I asked. Yep. But he didn't. Despite his prophet's warning that science generally hates beliefs, David held fast to this belief in a ladder. He clung to it in the face of waves of counter-evidence that should have eventually eroded it. When Darwin came along, debunking the idea of a divine plan, David accepted that Earth's creatures had come about accidentally, but he somehow found a way to preserve the idea of a hierarchy of perfection. He told himself that time, not God, had forged its shape, the slow tick of time forming fitter, more intelligent, more morally advanced forms of life. When he encountered the growing chorus of opposition to his eugenics agenda, when judges and lawyers and governors began trying to overturn eugenic laws, he wrote them off as sentimental, unscientific. When scientists began to question eugenics, to point out all its shoddy assumptions about the heritability of morality, about the concept of degeneration, he questioned their courage, their commitment to the cause of bettering society. But perhaps the most damning argument came from nature herself. Had David followed his own advice to look to nature for truth, he would have seen it. This dazzling, feathery, squawking, gurgling mound of counter-evidence. Animals can outperform humans on nearly every measure supposedly associated with our superiority. There are crows that have better memories than us, chimps with better pattern recognition skills, ants that rescue their wounded, and blood flukes with higher rates of monogamy. When you actually examine the range of life on Earth, it takes a lot of acrobatics to sort it into a single hierarchy with humans at the top. We don't have the biggest brain or the best memory. We're not the fastest or the strongest or the most prolific. We're not the only ones that mate for life, that show altruism, use tools, language. We don't have the most copies of genes in circulation. We aren't even the newest creation on the block. This was what Darwin was trying so hard to get his readers to see. There is no ladder. Natura non facit saltum, he cries in his scientist tongue. There are no jumps. The rungs we see are figments of our imagination, more about convenience than truth. To Darwin, a parasite was not an abomination, but a marvel, a case of extraordinary adaptability. The sheer range of creatures in existence, great and small, feathered and glowing, goitered and smooth, was proof that there are endless ways of surviving and thriving in this world. So why was David unable to see it? This mountain of counter-evidence stacked up against his faith in a ladder. Why would he protect it, this arbitrary belief about how plants and creatures should be arranged? When challenged, why would he only double down and use it to justify such violent measures? Perhaps because his belief gave him something more important than truth. Not just that first spark of purpose as a young man on Penikese, not just a career and a cause and a wife and a cushy life, but something even more profound. A way of turning that roiling morass of the sea of the stars of his dizzying life into clear, shining order. To let go at any point, from his first read of Darwin to his last push for eugenics, would have been to invite a return to vertigo. He would have been transported back to being that lost little boy, shaking before a world that had just taken his brother, a terrified child powerless before the world with no way of understanding or controlling it. To let go of that hierarchy would be to release a tornado of life. Beetles and hawks and bacteria and sharks swirling high into the air all around him, above him. It would have been too disorienting. It would have been chaos. It would have been the very same vision of the world I myself had been fighting so hard not to look at ever since I was a little girl. That sense of falling off the edge of the world, plummeting alongside ants and stars with no purpose or point. Of glimpsing the glaring, relentless truth so clear from inside the swirl of chaos. You don't matter. That's what the ladder offered David. An antidote. A foothold. The lovely, warm feeling of significance. In that light, I could understand why he clung to it so tightly, this vision of a natural order, why he protected it so ferociously against morality, against reason, against truth. Even as I despised him for it, on some level, I craved the very same thing. I closed David Starr Jordan's autobiography, the second and final olive green volume. I set it on the nightstand in my little guest room in Heather's apartment in Chicago. The night air was quiet. Heather was staying across the city with her boyfriend. The hot light of the city screamed through the window. There were a few stars. They were hard to see, but they were there, winking behind the pink garbage mess we have made of the sky. I was back on the earth I had been trying so hard to escape. The bleak one with no refuge or promises no matter what you do, how much you believe in your mission, or how hard you repent. I had made a wreck of my life, and I wasn't going to lie to myself any longer. The curly-haired man was never coming back. David Starr Jordan wasn't going to lead me into some beautiful new existence. There was no way of overcoming chaos, no guide or shortcut or magic phrase to guarantee everything would end up okay. So what do you do after letting go of hope? Where do you go? Chapter 12, Dandelions. The road to Lynchburg is flanked by endless gun stores. Even the gas stations sell them. New Glock pistols, they say. Shooting range, 25% off ammo. I was driving to the Virginia State Colony for epileptics and feeble-minded. That fenced internment camp where David's wildest ideas had transmuted into reality, where thousands had been segregated from society, imprisoned, and sterilized. After crossing the James River, I turned right onto Colony Road, a one-lane road about a mile long. Just before the entrance to the colony, there's a gravel pull-off where you can behold the Blue Ridge Mountains rolling like lavender waves just out of reach. When I came to the gates, I discovered there are no longer any gates, just a large brick embankment off to one side, as if to remind motorists of the boundary that used to reign. A sign informed me that this was a tobacco-free facility, that it was now called the Central Virginia Training Center. I was shocked to learn that people with disabilities still lived here, that it still operated as a state-run care facility. It would close its doors a few years after I visited, though, when living conditions were found to be inadequate. The campus was even larger than I had imagined, sprawling with over 60 buildings, hundreds of acres. I parked my car in front of a foreboding brick building, four stories tall, with a white tower and a massive set of stairs leading to an entrance supported by six white columns. This was the main building where so many people had once been processed, examined, deemed unfit to carry on their genetic lines. The only other vehicle in the lot was a police car, parked over two spots. I wasn't sure if I was allowed to be here. Tentatively, I got out of my car. I began walking the paths. I walked by dozens of hulking brick buildings with black mold creeping up their sides. They were all abandoned. The functional part of the facility was located down the hill a bit, away from these grisly relics of the past. I walked by the remnants of a barn and field where the inmates had been forced to tend cows, hogs, and various crops at a profit to the colony. I walked by a gazebo, a swing set, a cemetery. Turkey buzzards circled in what seemed like an enlarged sky. I walked through the cemetery gates and discovered over 1,000 graves. Emma Bishop, 18 years old. Dorothy Mitchell, 12 years old. Alfred Snyder, 3 years old. Each gravestone was a small flat rectangle, flush with the dirt. I kept walking. I had the chilling thought that this faraway, desolate hilltop was ground zero for eugenic extermination. The very mindset we define our national identity in opposition to. The evil that we tell our school children started with the Nazis, the others, the bad guys. We were the first in the world to make it national policy. Finally, I made it to the building where Carrie Buck was sterilized. It was a squat brick box with rotting edges. The floorboards on its porch were falling out. A drain pipe had rusted off. There was a chain obstructing its steps. Danger, do not enter. Below the porch, a basement window was open. I crawled over to it and peered inside to see a series of sunken rooms with dilapidated walls. A cold rush of air smacked me in the face. I looked upward to a window on the top floor. Four of its panes of glass were punched out. A white curtain billowed in the breeze, not realizing there was no one left inside to protect from the sun, to soothe, to hide. I would never be able to ask Carrie Buck about what happened to her here. She died in 1983 in a nursing home in Virginia. Her daughter Vivian had died decades earlier at the age of 8 due to complications from the measles, shortly after making honor roll at the local elementary school. But eventually, after months of searching, I was able to find a woman who knew these colony grounds all too well, who had spent the majority of her childhood locked inside them. Her name is Anna, and she looks like she could be friends with your mom. Short gray haircut, floral blouse, carrying a purse. The first time I met her, we convened at a Dairy Queen. We both got vanilla ice cream cones dipped in chocolate. She told me that underneath her blouse, there is a large scar that runs vertically up her abdomen. It is purple and gnarled in some spots. She says she does her best not to look at it, in the shower, in the mirror, as she is getting dressed in the morning. I think about it every day, though. She was sterilized against her will at the Lynchburg facility when she was 19 years old. The year was 1967, but she had first landed inside its brick walls 12 years earlier, when she was just 7 years old. She and her brothers had been spotted by neighbors playing naked and unattended in a pen behind their home. State workers had come to take them away. It didn't matter that the kids didn't want to go. Anna loved her mom, her long hair and overalls, how she'd let Anna climb into bed with her when the nights were cold. But the combination of the neighbors' worries, her parents' poverty, and Anna's low score on an intelligence test were enough to deem this 7-year-old unfit, a threat to humankind. Anna remembers being driven, in a patrol car of some sort, up that long, narrow road toward the colony on its hill, a gate opening, a guard waving them through. She and her brothers were marched up big steps into a foreboding brick building. She had no idea why they were there. They did not sterilize her right away. First, she was made to cut her long hair. Then she was issued an inmate number, and finally she was made to wait. Year after year to wait, while an alternate childhood roamed free just outside those gates, through the blue-ridged silhouettes in the distance. She said that they were treated like animals in the colony, corralled into large sleeping quarters, forced to work with no pay, made to line up outside as they waited for meals, even if it was raining, even if it was sleeting. If they disobeyed, they were put in the blind room. There were no lights in the blind room, no windows. They were left in the dark, sometimes for days, without food or water or a toilet. She remembers the urine pooling beneath her bare feet. She is shy when she tells me about being raped. Not in the blind room, no. In her psychologist's office. He closed the door and tied her legs to the examining table. Anna was told that if she wanted to leave the colony, it was easy. Just agree to be sterilized, they said, and she would be free. But little Anna refused. She'd heard about people dying on the operating table. She'd watched the little cemetery slowly fill with more and more gravestones. Plus, she wanted to have kids. Kids were her only dream. She wanted to build a busy home full of laughter and warmth. She knew she could do it, and her keepers must have known it too on some level, because Anna's job in the colony was to care for other inmates, to bathe them, sing to them, help them into their pajamas, rock them to sleep. Fit to care for the state's children, but not her own. For years, she refused to be sterilized, hoping that someone, her parents, her president, someone somewhere fighting for good, would come and set her free. She refused to give her captors the one part of her identity she wanted to keep for herself, mother. She refused to hand over the one source of hope keeping her going. One day in the early 60s, a little girl showed up at the colony. Her name was Mary, and she was shaken, afraid, wanting very much to go home. I told her, don't worry, everything will be okay, said Anna. And then 13-year-old Anna took little Mary under her wing. She pushed her on the swings, let her cling to her dress as they talked to boys, told her which staff members to avoid and which had candy. Mary would later tell me that she's not sure how she would have survived her time there without Anna. Eventually, Anna's adolescence gave way to adulthood. With new muscles of the leg, of the mind, Anna managed to escape over the fence and into the woods. She ran, down the hill, through the trees, toward the mountains, toward the train tracks, toward anything else. But she was picked up by police before even making it into town. They drove her back up to the colony. The gates closed behind her, and she was beaten for having tried, her head pounded into a wall. Unfit, not a judgment, just a fact of life. Then, on a muggy August day in 1967, a few months after she'd turned 19, a nurse told Anna that she had to have a checkup. She led her to an examining room, strapped a mask to her face, and left the room. Anna watched the walls around her start to wave and blur. She figured she was being euthanized. "I thought I was gone and I wasn't going to wake up," she told me. "But I woke up." Wake up she did, to a bandage on her stomach, 25 crudely tied stitches trying to conceal the sight of a robbery. No one told her what they had done to her. They just told her she would soon be free to leave. Nowadays, Anna lives in a two-bedroom apartment just a few miles from where the colony still looms on its hill. The other occupant of the home is Mary, her close friend from youth. The two have lived together for the past decade or so. After being released from the Lynchburg facility, Mary married Anna's brother, Roy. While the marriage didn't last long, Anna and Mary had so loved the feeling of being legal family, sisters-in-law, that they've called themselves sisters ever since. Anna opens the door when I arrive. Mary is sitting in a lazy boy and waves at me with her cane, beckoning for a hug. I hear birds squawking. The women introduce me to their pair of parakeets, Pretty Boy and Pretty Girl. One yellow, one blue. There is a jungle of plants, IVs and succulents and hanging philodendrons. On the couch, sitting upright in a white onesie and tiny pink sneakers, is a doll. A perfect replica of a human infant with marble blue eyes and plastic lips. Mary gives me a hug. Anna hurries to the kitchen to get me some iced tea. She refills Mary's glass while she's at it. Then she settles into a matching lazy boy next to Mary and tells me how they moved into houses on the same street after making it out of the colony. "They told Anna she couldn't take care of kids, but she took care of my kid," Mary says. Mary was able to escape sterilization at the colony and a few years later had a son with her second husband. Anna lived just a few doors down and would come over at the drop of a hat to babysit. Anytime I needed her, she was always there. "He was a sweet baby, he sure was," says Anna. She tells me about taking him to the park, about how he loved to be chased, squealing, then turning back around to make sure she was still chasing him. Eventually, she trails off. "I always wanted kids, but I couldn't have none." "Eh," Mary says, swatting the air quick with a joke about how kids aren't all they're cracked up to be. "I mean, the doctor bills alone." Anna's shoulders start bouncing, then Mary's go too. The room fills with laughter, Mary's brassy coughs, and Anna's softer chuckles. Anna brings out a picture of Mary's son, now a grown man. He has dark hair, a movie star chin, his arm around a brood of his own children. "Tell her about your baby," Mary says, and Anna finally introduces me to the doll sitting on the couch. "This is little Mary," she says. She tells me she brings little Mary everywhere, to church, to Walmart, into bed with her each night. She says that a few years ago, a freak cyclone destroyed the trailer in which they'd been living. She and human Mary had been out that day, but the doll had been trapped under fallen debris. Now she can't bear to ever leave her alone again. Mary jumps in to say that sometimes Anna gets strange looks for carrying her doll around. Just the other day, there was a woman on the bus staring at her. I told Anna, "Don't put that baby to the side." I said, "Hug her. Don't pay no attention to what people say about your baby. That's your baby." Anna smiles and gives the doll's bald head a little peck. She taps a doll bottle against its hard lips, dabs away imaginary milk. She draws the doll to her chest, vanishes into the embrace for just a moment, then reappears to bounce her, burp her, thump the cotton of her back. When I asked Anna what she thought of people like David Starr Jordan, the ones who peddled the ideas that would steal so much away from her freedom, her childhood, her dream of having children, she said she felt angry. But she tries not to focus on the anger, not to look at the scar. Instead, she lives the hell out of the life the eugenicists didn't think she was worthy of living. She drinks her iced tea ice cold. She waters her plants. She colors. Page after page of cheerful animals. A surfing fox, a kayaking wolf, a rabbit, a snail, and a butterfly dancing in a conga line. She saves her scant money to cheer up her friend. After Mary found out that her son and grandkids wouldn't be able to visit for Christmas the past year, Anna rushed out and got her the best present she could think of: a living, breathing, heart-beating hamster. Mary was overcome when she saw him. She named him Sugarfoot and shows me how she greets him each morning, scooping him from his cage and pressing his tiny, twitching cheek against hers. You can almost hear a purr. Inside the birdcage, a miniature disco ball turns in the sunlight, throwing dozens of tiny sparkles across the room. Pretty boy and pretty girl flit their wings as if clapping. The ice cubes in everybody's glasses pop and tinkle as the morning whirls on. The living room is a menagerie of movement and light and laughter and warmth. The living room is alive. As I drove away from their home that day, I thought about the eugenicist belief that these lives were not worthy of life, that these lives were somehow a danger to society. It made me furious. I thought about the gnarled scar on Anna's abdomen. I wondered what it would feel like to look down and see a Supreme Court-sanctioned stamp of unworthiness, to know that the purple ribbon of it had been intended as a gift, the nation's mercy of letting you finish out your years instead of killing you as they would have wished on the spot. I thought about the fact that had David Starr Jordan looked at my sister, he probably would have deemed her unfit because she gets flustered at cash registers, okay? I thought about how he likely would have deemed me unfit, too, my sadness repugnant to him, a sign of moral failure, a sulfur-breathed waste of a life. I wanted to have some amazing retort, some grandstandy way of telling him how wrong he was, that we matter. But as soon as I'd feel my fist lifting, my brain would tug it back. Because, of course, we don't. We don't matter. This is the cold truth of the universe. We are specks flickering in and out of existence with no significance to the cosmos. To ignore this truth is, oddly enough, to behave exactly like David Starr Jordan, whose ridiculous belief in his own superiority allowed him to perpetrate such unthinkable violence. No, to be clear-eyed and good was to concede with every breath, with every step, our insignificance. To say otherwise was to sin, to lie, to march oneself off toward delusion, madness, or worse. It was a tangle, an Ouroboros eating its tail, a blue-tailed skink climbing for vengeance, only to get smacked down by the truth of the eagle on high. I felt stuck. I had asked Anna a stupid question as I sat with her and Mary in their living room that morning, a selfish and indulgent question. After she had told me tales of her internment, of her abuse, of her rape, of being called retarded, of being pushed in the mud, of her jaw being broken, of her reproductive organs being mutilated, I had asked her, "How do you go on?" It was the question I'd been asking of everyone, in a way, for my whole life. It was the reason I'd spent so many years researching David Starr Jordan's life. It was the question I'd asked my father when I was a little girl. It was why I'd been so reluctant to let go of the curly-haired man, his mesmerizing way of pulling laughter from the cold earth. That levity was a quality I wanted to be near, the substance I wanted to learn how to manufacture in myself, the recipe that, as far and wide as I searched, I seemed unable to find. Anna looked at me, unsure. She began to think about it. I looked at the plants to give her some space. Finally, Mary jumped in. "Because of me." Anna started laughing. "Sure, right, of course, because of Mary." It was a joke, Mary's way of saving us all from my misstep. But the more I thought back on it, the more I began to wonder about its truth. I thought back on their apartment, the matching lazy boys, the matching parakeets, the matching glasses of iced tea, the doll propped up on the couch, the hamster whirling in its cage. I started to see this thing I had not consciously noticed as I was sitting there, this sort of invisible thread between the two women.